Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real engineers get together to talk nerdy. Yes, it's a special place where we never have to apologize that you, dear listener, don't know what a packet or a router is. Here in our virtual boardroom, we have this special cherished place where we gather to gesticulate at the virtual whiteboard, get excited about technology, disappointed about reality, and so much more. Let's face it, discussing networking technologies is what the packet pushers care about. Before we leap into today's show, I just want to give a plug. We have a webinar coming up on December the 6th. We are recording a webinar with Big Switch. Big Switch has recently come out of stealth mode and launching their big network controller into the industry. They've come to the Packet Pushers to have a technical deep dive on their product and present it to you. So here's your opportunity to join in on the SDN OpenFlow and get a first-hand briefing from Big Switch. You'll be able to go over to the Packet Pushers website and find a banner there which you can click through to register for the webinar. The webinar will run for about 60 minutes, maybe 90 minutes long. We'll go through a presentation. I think we're hoping to do a demonstration on the Big Switch controller so you can actually see some stuff about it and use some of the applications and actually see some of this SDN OpenFlow stuff which we've been flabbering on about for quite some time. So please come on over to thepacketpushers.net and register for that webinar. Without further ado, let's leap in. Of course, I'm Greg Farrow, returning from my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitter as at etherealmind. Joining us this week is Brent Salisbury. How are you today, Brent?
Doing well, sir. Good to talk to you, Greg.
Yeah, once again, why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself?
By day, I'm a network architect at a higher ed university here in the States. We have a hospital and a campus, so keeps us busy there at night. And other than that, I play with lots of SDN unicorns and rodeos and do some of that kind of stuff here in Kentucky.
And your blog is networkstatic.com?
Yes, sir.
And you're on the Twitter as
at Network Static.
That's right. And if you are ever at all interested in networking and from a Linux point of view in terms of scripting and how to build your own OpenStack and your own OpenFlow and stuff like that, I highly recommend Brett's blog. He's actually posting screencasts of him building stuff on his laptop, building an OpenStack on his laptop, which is pretty cool. And I'm jealous that you've got that much time, to be fair.
There's not a lot of sleep that's involved there. So.
Yeah. And also with us this week is Bob McCouch. Bob, tell the people a little bit about yourself.
Oh, thanks, Greg. Really thrilled to be here. Work engineer for a partner in the Eastern Pennsylvania region of the United States. And I work with customers who are generally in the 500 to 2500 or 3000 port range, doing just about everything, primarily route switch, a lot of firewall work, and also wireless when it's called upon, some data center stuff and Nexus. That's about it. I've been doing this stuff for a little over 10 years now, and it's kind of my life. I'm working toward the CCIE route switch exam. I'm exam attempt lined up in February, so we'll give it another shot and see how that goes.
Well, good luck with that. I hope you find time to get the study done. Thanks for joining us on the show. I know we've been... So thanks for joining us. And also, as always, Mr. Ethan Banks is with us again this week. How are you, sir?
Tired. It was a week of vacation last week, and so I came back just, exhausted, which is... Although that's misleading the way I said that, because the reality is I did have a relaxed week. I sat and I worked on some CCIE research stuff, spent some time getting GNS3 set up and working on Windows. First attempt was horribly bad. The second attempt with a reinstall went very well, and now I can't seem to break it. Oh. And and in that sense, it was good, but now I'm looking at my schedule for the upcoming next, between now and the end of the year, and it's I'm already exhausted just looking at the schedule. Not cool at all.
Yes, I too. Although I am looking forward to having a Christmas off. I've actually got this idea about writing an article. I remember when I first started in networking back in 96, we would always work Christmas. I could never have Christmas off because at Christmas time, once the 21st of December went past, everybody would start doing all this stuff to their networking and their servers. We'd actually tear them down and replace them because there was nobody in the office. And for the next 2 weeks, from the 21st of December through to the 7th of January, we did all the big network upgrades and the server upgrades and changed tape drives and, replaced hard drives, rebuilt servers and stuff like that. These days, everybody shuts their businesses down on the 14th of December and no changes until the 14th of January. Nothing gets done. I was just thinking how life has changed in the last, say, 15 years.
Well, and I think along with that, we're not allowed to make any networking changes anymore because nothing can ever be down, so we stick with what we have forever. I know you've talked on that some. So
that's spot serious. On. I can remember not thinking that I will never, ever get a Christmas off. The only day I ever got off was Christmas Day, but Boxing Day was always stuck in a data center tearing down a network that nobody used because it didn't have to run. And then ITIL came along and said, well, actually, you can't break something on a day, you know, on a public holiday because the tech support people might not be available in case you need them. And I'm thinking, I've never needed them before. Why would I need them now? You know? But anyway, I was just thinking that. So, you know, bring on Christmas and sitting around for 3 or 4 weeks. But I've got a break over Christmas, which is going to be different. I haven't done that in a long time.
Cool platform.
Am I crazy to so we've just built some new data centers, and so we're running MPLS in the data centers because that's the only way that I see to scale path isolation. I mean, VLANs don't scale. I need it's my bucket where I put a bunch of VLANs that are distributed in either east-west or between multiple data centers into one container, so that A, I'm reducing my bridging domain, and B, I'm not having to duplicate policy, you know, through a choke point of firewall.
Is how big is your scale again? I mean, you're really big, right?
Well, it's a hospital with three or four data centers, and then campus enterprise with a couple data centers and a DR. I mean, just private VLANs don't feel right, and then everything else is just dangerous because it's, you know, bridging loop potential or unicast flooding and everything else that comes with it. Greg posted a tweet the other day that was, MPLS has no business in the data center, and it broke my heart.
The problem I'm having with MPLS in the data center is that data center switches don't support it. The Nexus 7000 doesn't do it. Only just the latest version of code. But it's not validated and it's not supported and it won't be supported by Cisco in terms of a GD, you know, like a reliable release for at least another year, probably two. So how the hell am I supposed to build a multi, you know, a virtual data center with Nexus when it doesn't even support MPLS? And even when I get it, I still have to go through all the excruciating pain of dicking around with LDP and MPLS and exporting routes between VRFs. I actually need something far more reliable than MPLS. I don't trust MPLS to work the way I configure it because it's got a mind of its own. If your network isn't configured the way you think it is and somebody configures, like I have a network which is run by, designed by one team, architected by another team and implemented by another team, and the people who implement it every day come from a rotating pool of 100 people. So I never get the same person doing the configuration twice, which means I can't rely on them to do the same thing twice. So I have this massive problem where MPLS is not reliable enough. It requires special skills, a knowledge of the network architecture that you're working in, people who know exactly what will happen. If I redistribute this route from this VRF to this VRF at this location, what will happen?
Right.
You don't know, you know, unless you've got an app from someone like Carradine, you're never going to know.
Yeah, and so I totally agree on importing that. Supporting VRFs, but typically the egress of a VPN, MPLS VPN in a data center is going to be a firewall. So, yeah. You know, there's no point in creating an MPLS VPN or a VRF if you're not applying policy between those containers. So I do think it is supported. I just want to throw that out there.
It is supported. And I think, Greg, your point is it's not supported in the mature, yes, we've been doing this for a long time and we're really comfortable with MPLS code and NXOS way that you want it to be.
Yeah, right. I can't just go and buy, I can't go and take 6.1025 16,272 point alpha, beta, gamma, delta, you know, and then put it in and see how it goes, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm only allowed to do the code upgrade once every 5 years. So I need to...
If that.
You know, so I can't do MPLS in my data center because the Nexus doesn't support it. So it's a non-starter. I need a better way. I actually, you know, and even when I put a server into one VRF, sometimes I actually want it to be in multiple VRFs. And I want it to be in multiple VRFs depending on the source destination pairing, right? Or in some cases, I've now got a problem where in a virtual server, so I now have a cluster of 40 UCS blades in a VMware stack, and I can't extend MPLS into there either. Putting them into VLANs means I don't even know where the endpoints for my VERFs are. MPLS has no point in a virtualized environment. It's a useless technology until it can get down to the virtual switch. And it will never get down to the virtual switch because running LDP as an autonomous protocol in a virtualization stack isn't going to happen, because virtualization people don't use autonomous protocols in their systems. They say they configure everything. If I click this, this will happen. If I click this, this will happen. They don't click a button and then a dynamic protocol suddenly just sends the server to wherever it's going to be. No, they say this server is going to be instantiated on this physical box. That's where it goes. That we know that. Click it, it's done. The only time that's not true is when DRS works, but that's because everything that's inside the DRS cluster is designed so that it's inside of that physical space. MPLS VERFs have no place in that environment. Nobody is going to start extending MPLS down to where the servers are to build multi-tenant environments. Therefore, MPLS in the data center is pointless. Until it can get all the way out to the edge where the servers actually are, MPLS is not a data center technology. It's a WAN technology. Connects a few things together. It might even be used for, you know, some nominal separation between firewall zones up in a DMZ or an isolation zone or around the barrier, around the edge, you know, where the crunchy edge is, but no place in the data center core because it doesn't support virtualization, and it never will.
Okay, so you at least said it should, a PE as an aggregation can have a place in the data center, because you just crushed all my hopes and dreams of a vendor ever providing anything south of it. But as long as I have that, I'm okay.
Well, Brent, I don't think you're, you know, crazy for running MPLS in there. A friend of mine that he and I worked together at a financial institution doing architecture work, and I no longer deal with that network, but he and I chatted for a while about some redesign stuff that he was thinking about, and MPLS to separate several different of the environments came up as a way to consolidate the hardware, provide a security termination, basically handing off traffic exiting a VERF into a big freaking firewall cluster that he was building, and then the firewall would do the routing in between. It would maybe hairpin around, go back into the same switching hardware, but a different VRF at that point, just depending on what the traffic flows were like. And it made sense. Smaller physical footprint, you get your isolation, you have your security, you could control it, and you could scale it out bigger if you needed. So it worked in that scenario. But there was specific reasons. It was very security-driven. That was the cause of it, in addition to just wanting to consolidate some hardware and not have unique cores for all these different environments. MPLS was the separator, if you will.
Right, perfect. Okay, and that's exactly what this is. It's not being able to afford multiple control plane, you know, distributed routers for each of the custom-built security zones. So, great.
So, I was talking to somebody about OpenFlow recently. And basically, in OpenFlow, if you're defining a flow, say by MAC source, MAC destination, source IP, destination IP, you don't need MPLS. You don't need a tag, because the state's actually contained in the network, not in the packet. Mm-hmm. So in MPLS, you add a tag, and that signals the state to each hop of the network. Well, you know what? My network is not a hop-by-hop network anymore. It is a stateful, flow-based system. I need to have linear flows traveling from point to point in my network that I know exactly what's happening. Okay?
Amen.
Make an exception, right? That's the future. And an MPLS tag is not that expression of that intention. I can't – if I put a tag on an MPLS, I cross my fingers and hope it gets to the other end, because it'll go wherever the hell MPLS and LDP and BGP wants to send it. And that might not be the way I think it is, unless I've got enough time to research it and make sure it's happened. So I was actually looking at VLAN tags in a pure OpenFlow enabled network. A VLAN tag actually is redundant; it has no meaning whatsoever, except maybe to act as a billing marker.
You're exactly right.
So at that point, the tag is actually quite a neat billing marker. If you count up all the packets with this VLAN tag, then you can calculate how much data this customer sent. So you can have 4,000 customers, and each one of those customers is a tag. You can have as many flows as you like. You don't need VLANs, because every flow is defined by source IP, destination IP, maybe MAC address. So it's because you, the old days of packets, every day, everything we do in our network today is routed by destination. Why are we not routing by source too? because that's too hard to create an automatic protocol for. OpenFlow says, well, we don't need to know about the destination. You know, we don't just route on the destination. We don't care where it's going to. We actually care about where it's coming from, what port on the device it arrived from. You know, what, you know, all this sort of stuff can actually be combined to make a whole new capability.
It's a grown-up version of policy-based routing, if you will. It's extensible and scalable in that construct, plus you get to apply whatever logic you like to it if you have a controller that you can program to do whatever your nefarious will is as far as source routing.
Well, I think, and you guys have described the current networks today on one of the podcasts before, is you're putting the envelope in the mailbox, and if it gets there, it gets there, and you hope it does, and it doesn't matter. The return address really doesn't mean anything unless you're troubleshooting, right? So this idea that, you know, the data center is going to be a /8, and all your tenancy and all your policy is now all part of the flow instantiation, it's a reason this is disruptive, right? Because it can blow people's minds. What do you mean? It's going to be just everything's flat? Well, yeah, because the flow is where, as you said, the flow is where the state is, and that's where the value is.
Brings us back to the crossroads, though, of our nature, I think, as network engineers, to have this very tight deterministic control over everything that's happening in our data center, and yet the need of the businesses that we do our work for to be, you know, fast and flexible and ready to deploy something new very quickly.
What I'm doing right now, I mean, I'm dealing with right now is just having to say no over and over and over to systems folks. They need to be able to, you know, the business case is I need to be able to vMotion from either east, west, but at the same time the business is saying this network has to be available 100% of the time. Those two things do not, you know, those are completely opposed to one another, you know. Flexibility does not equal uptime in current construct.
I'm really struggling at the moment with automated protocols. We think we actually have control of the network, and you made a point there, Bob, which it took me a while to realize it. I don't have control of my network. OSPF does, or BGP does, or MPLS, LDP. It decides what the architecture is going to look like. And the only way I know that I'm in control of my network is by plugging the cables in a certain place to force it to work in a certain way that then I know what it's doing. That's not control. That's lack of control.
Nick McCune describes it as the global view, right? So when we see our global view today is the router looking at one of thousands of routers, and his view of the topology in the network is just from his little world. So we build networks that are all they might as well be, if you have 1,000 routers in your network, you might as well have 1,000 autonomous systems in your network, because that's how, you know, the protocols are built.
That's exactly what we have. Now, that used to be a good idea. So for WAN, that's still a great idea. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got a WAN with 1,000 nodes that are distributed by, you know, all over the world, you want things to fail and to locate or redundant paths automatically and find their way back home. Inside a data center, I no longer see that these autonomous protocols make any sense, because we now need features that they cannot support.
Ethan, I got to hear your thoughts, boss. You're my sound of reason. I kid you not. You and Ivan, I've got to hear it.
So, Bob, something you had said a little bit earlier, I've been pondering here, which is we as network engineers want to maintain control of the network, very, very tight control. And then, you know, Greg, a little bit later, you kind of jumped off of that and said, well, we don't really have control. The protocols have control. The most control we have is where we plug in. You could add to that, yeah, we can manipulate metrics and, you know, we can force things with PBR or whatever. But I think to follow on, Bob, to what you were saying is that we want control. And because of that, we're also really resistant to change. As we've talked about SDN on the show quite a lot over the 2012, we've got a pretty vocal group of people, many of you that are listening right now, that are saying, would you shut up about it already, because I don't care. It doesn't matter in my world. SDN is irrelevant. Right. Okay. And that is because we are people that are resistant to change, and that change that SDN represents is so massive compared to what we've been doing that it's very intimidating. It's very, I don't want to look at
changing how my network forwards traffic in such a drastically different way, that is frightening. Darn it, I just figured out this whole OSPF thing, and whether it controls the network or whether I control it, I'm not sure, but it doesn't matter. I'm comfortable with how it works, and that's where I want things to be. So, without a doubt,
I think the kind of the key thing there is that it's not that even for anybody that says, you know, SDN is not anything that I need to worry about, or OpenFlow is not anything I need to worry about. It's even if you don't need to deploy that tomorrow or next month or next year, I think it signals the kind of flexibility that IT systems overall are moving toward. That kind of, again, that kind of flexible, fast deployment, self-provisioning kind of thing. And so I think that the takeaway there is, even if you're not worried about how you're going to deploy OpenFlow or SDN, it's a, you know, like that's the canary in the mine, right? You know, be ready to be that flexible, you know, next year or the year after or something, even if you're not now. But I think we, as you know, we fashion ourselves engineers, whether some of us have engineering degrees or not. But I think it signals our desire to understand the systems that we are building and supporting, because that understanding, that thorough grokking of those systems is what gives us the ability to predict, anticipate, and resolve problems, right? And I think that's what all of us want to be able to do with, you know, real superhuman capability, right? It's just know everything that could go wrong. And I think a lot of us feel like as we start to give ourselves up to more automation of the network and more, go ahead, Mr. Server Guy, just provision a new server. You need an additional VLAN that does this. It's automatic. Just it'll build itself. I think we feel like we are giving up that control.
Well, it's not that we feel it. We are. We're giving up that control. We are turning over provisioning to a vendor's software programming and trusting that they don't suck at it, which historically hasn't been a good bet.
Well, you've already lost that control today, right? As soon as you trunk a VLAN out to a server, you've lost it, right? Once you give that VLAN to a vSwitch in a VMware stack, you have no control over what happens after that. What you want is to get that control back. Not VLANs, not OSPF, not MPLS can get that back for you. You have to go somewhere else to get that control back. And the only way to do that, so one way would be to implement NetFlow on every port everywhere in your network and store all of that data in a big Hadoop cluster, and you could analyze every single packet and know where everything's going. And that isn't going to happen because that's an unviable amount of data, right?
Not right.
Right? So you have to come up with a different way. And I'm really just focusing on the data center here, right? There's a couple of use cases where OpenFlow makes sense. The data center is one of them. Let me just jump back to one point. OSPF isn't going to go away. Neither is MPLS or BGP. They are all core technology sets that we need to know. OpenFlow is going to come along and it's going to be additional to. It is
Google,
a new
case in point.
That's right. Google still uses BGP to talk to the peers on the internet. Google still uses OSPF for certain areas of their internal network. They only use OpenFlow on their WAN connections between their data centers to schedule traffic loads during the day. And that's where we're going to be for the next 5 years or 10 years while OpenFlow arrives. I'm not saying, so for now, if you're studying for, you know, certification, you need to know OSPF, you need to know packets, you need to know QoS, you need to know VLAN tags, you need to know how the physical device, you need to know silicon, you need to understand voice packets and quality of service and jitter and delay. You need to understand that BGP is a path vector protocol. And what does that mean? Because those protocols are going to come back to us in the OpenFlow, because the apps that sit on top of an OpenFlow network will still use the same mathematical concepts. The BGP path vector is actually based on a network graph technology, and the network graph technology is a mathematical function for calculating paths through the network. The math isn't going to change when we go up to SDN. The only thing that matters is how we configure the little device. So instead of sitting at a CLI and twitching your little fingers typing in pointless commands, and then that being a skill, like your skill today is typing on Cisco IOS and being able to type conf-t in VLAN 10, that's not a skill. That's just something that you learn by sheer dint of repetition.
It's a process. You know? It's not, yeah. It's all it
the
is.
Knowledge that you learned is, why do you have a VLAN? You have a VLAN tag. The tag is there in an Ethernet frame because it allows a silicon in an Ethernet switch to pick it up before the IP header gets analyzed. That's what the purpose of a tag. So if I don't have a tag, how do I then classify the traffic? Well, the only reason we never routed via a MAC address was because Silicon wasn't capable of doing that. VLAN tags gave us a universal marker. And that's a 20-year-old technology that's no longer relevant because chips are getting more powerful, silicon's getting more powerful, and that's where the change comes in. So all of that technology we know today stays the same. We still do OSPF. We still need spanning tree. That spanning tree ain't going to go away in my lifetime. We still need Trill because we're going to use that in certain places too because it'll do certain things for it.
Oh, and I think Ethan really nails it with, you know, it's the fear of change. I think if we go back and look at the x86 market and you know, maybe take a look at the systems guide 10 years ago that, you know, got therapy to deal with P to V and consolidation and that he's no longer going to be pulling out dead bays, dead storage drives and replacing them physically, and he's going to be focusing on policy on this central pile of compute, storage, and soon-to-be network. That's our roadmap, and it's pretty clear. I think the only question is, can we do it faster?
Well, storage is changing too, because now they're talking about distributed storage. So, for example, companies like Scale Computing and Nervanix, every time you put a server into a Nervanix farm, they put a cluster of hard drives in with it. And then the storage in the cluster gets distributed across all hard drives in the cluster. They don't use a storage array. Every time you add another server, you're actually adding CPU, memory, and storage. And it's distributed amongst the whole thing. You don't know where your files are. They're just there somewhere. So storage is even moving away from the tradition of that's where the storage is. It's in that array. And it's actually being distributed all around the data center. So they're losing that control. They're being disintermediated. The same thing's happening in the server platform. Like, if you feel like you're being persecuted, give that up too. The server guys, once upon a time, you walked up with a CD and you popped out the CD-ROM with a little blue light on the front, popped it in and you booted up, and that's where your server went. And that's what your job was. You went around and you hugged your server. You know, server huggers was the old joke. That's all changed with virtualization, right? You know, the guys who said, I've got to go down the data center and see what the server's doing? Because you can't possibly not, you know, look under their desk and there's 15 servers stacked up because you've got to have one just in case you need it. Those days are gone. Servers have changed. Applications have changed. Where's the old days? In the old days, everybody had a Microsoft server and they were using Microsoft.net to develop the apps. Today, we've got people running Linux and open source and now they're running, you know, stacks with Ruby and Python and Perl. We have the desktops are all changing. Today, you know, the last decade, we've had Microsoft Windows XP. Now we're looking at Windows 7 or, you know, even Windows 8. Some people are even talking about replacing laptops with iPads. Networking's not the only technology in the IT infrastructure stack that's changing. It's everything. It's right across the board. We've had a decade of stagnation in corporate IT, and change is being forced upon us. We have to – and it's not just us. It's everybody. Well, we're not special.
I mean, you're dead on. And it's how do we absorb the growth that's on the horizon? Today we have 300,000 mobile devices. I read research yesterday. By 2020, there's going to be 20 billion devices. So how we're doing it today, can we absorb that?
I was walking around the office the other day, and I realized that I noticed that my iPhone and my iPad were connecting to my Mac, and they were all connected to the corporate guest wireless. I have three devices. You know?
I misspoke, by the way. It's 300 million today. I meant to say
300
that,
but, million, yeah. But I thought you were talking about your university campus. Oh,
well, that's another fun one. So 2 years ago this day, we would peak at 3,802.11 devices. 2 years later, we peak at over 30,000. At one time, 30,000 on one wireless network. And if that was wired, we would not be able to absorb that. It's the oversubscription that wireless brings that we can absorb it. But it's also the centralized policy point for us to be able to do that. And you just send somebody out with an AP, they plug it in and go. So when people say, you know, nobody's doing SDN, hell yes, we're doing SDN. It's on the wireless networks in your enterprises today. It's a centralized control point.
Yeah, I've been doing networking 15 years. I started in data networking in 1996, was when I first started working for a networking company full-time. So, I don't know, do the maths from there, whatever the hell that is. And when I first started, I was known in the engineering team for being the guy who could configure Cisco routers to run Microsoft networking on a 5-point frame relay network. that was my, and I was like one of the best people to be able to do that. I could get Microsoft NetBIOS working over Frame Relay on Cisco routers. I was at the time thought highly of for that. A five node network, a five, you know, five WAN locations, the five head offices of the company in the capital cities. They had more branches everywhere. It was just the head offices being connected. Can you imagine doing that today in the scale? And I mean, I was connecting, we had racks, you know, we were connecting machine, you know, we were connecting Ethernet networks with 200 ports and it was huge. I was connecting FIDI backbones in hospitals and we had 500 desktops and 40 servers connected to them, and that was like an absolutely an enormous network at the time when we first started. The scale that's going on, it hasn't changed, right? You're talking about a tenfold increase in 2 years. That's a staggering increase, but that's the same sort of pace that's been going on for more than a decade. What we're seeing now is the same as it's always been. Maybe it's a bit faster this year than last year, but change has always happened. Networking has, you know, the only thing that's changed in networking now in the last 10 years is that OSPF got well understood and stabilized. It got reliable. Now we all understand BGP. I mean, I remember first configuring BGP in 1998 on a 2 meg E1 line and picking up the whole of the BGP root table, and then it blew up because the BGP code was unstable. You know, it just flat out didn't work. You know, since then, and back then it was only 75,000 or 100,000 routes. I can't remember what it was. It was a long time ago. Things change, you know. Oh, and nothing changes at the same time, by the way, just in case you're feeling paranoid about that. We will still have OSPF. We will still have RIP. We will still have BGP. And all those technologies that you're learning today will all be useful tomorrow.
Absolutely.
And that's new will be on top of that.
And it's still IP under the hood. Maybe I think the best thing that could come out of it is we stop creating protocols through various bodies to solve corner cases. You know, let's improve
what?
The framework.
What, know, what would crazy. They work on? That's crazy talk.
My voice of reason.
Sorry, we need one more universal protocol so that we can stop having to create new protocols, right?
A protocol framework that plugins. Yes, we'll run the one protocol and then plug in what we need.
That's Mr. Scientist.
One protocol to rule them all. Yeah.
I'm just scared I just totally annoy people. I'm really screwed if SDN doesn't work. I'm going to have to, like, go be a storage guy or something because I've got none of that jackass that was promoting. You know,
nothing. I was really bullish on EVB because I thought EVB. But EVB, if it's got a pulse, you know, I ain't seeing it. No one's talking to me about it.
Is that this 802.1 QBH or QBG?
Is
that those?
Well, there's still an initiative inside of Cisco. There's a guy called Rene Raber who's talking about 802.1BR, which is Cisco's successor to QBH. But, you know, and they're building it into their FEX products so that a UCS FEX would actually be able to communicate in an open standard way with the upstream 5500 or the FI, and so that there would be vendor interoperability. But the other vendors aren't interested, and that's because the stacks are closing. So HP doesn't want to have, you know, And if we're going to go with flow-based networking, which is far more universal and far more useful because it exposes the SDN applications, then why would we bother with that? So, you know, I can't see. If it's not flow-based networking, what is it? The only other way to do it was...
the same way we've been doing it for the last 25 years. That's
yeah. That's not networking, right? That's not scaling.
You know, I've gotten to the point where it's just like the L2 through 4 headers need to be, they're just a blank canvas. And some application needs to be able to plug in whatever they want to in those.
Move away from networking to full networking. Devices need to have stuff. Instead of running off a stateless tag in a header, that's ridiculous, surely.
But it just wrecks so many hardware plays. And from security to load balancing, and it's so disruptive. We're gonna get run over in the parking lot by some product manager at some point.
They just take their software off the hardware and put it into a VM.
Right.
It's what Riverbed did.
Yeah.
It's what Silver did.
A10.
They had five at launch. Caridin. Anybody know Caridin?
No.
Carrot's MPLS network analysis for carriers. So their software reads in all the network data and then tells them what their network looks like, because that's the only way you can model a network in a carrier.
Well, but you were one of the first people to really talk about that is the big data play of networking. So much data just goes off into nowhere that should be getting leveraged, just at least for management. Even more importantly, is for predictive analysis and start crunching that data and do something with it. And that's that northbound app.
Well, I think we've just about kicked this to death. So let's say that's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. Once again, if you're still listening after this epic, I'd like to encourage you to go and sign up for the Big Switch webinar on December the 6th, where we will be talking more about SDN. Big Switch are sponsoring us to talk to you about their audience and demonstrate their OpenFlow controller, and we want you to find out more about them. And thanks to them for supporting us. I'd like to thank our external resources for joining us this week. Bob, tell us a little bit about what your week holds ahead for you and where we can find you.
Oh, let's see. Next week I'm doing another one of those Nexus 5K core builds, and I think some VPN migrations for somebody else, probably an ASA in there. So it'll be a good busy week. Some fun BGP stuff for a carrier customer. So it'll be a good week. You guys can catch me on Twitter. I'm at Bob McCouch. And on rare occasions, I managed to scrape together time to put a blog post up on packetpushers.net.
And thank you very much for joining in. And Mr. Salisbury, what are you going to be up to this week?
By day, data centers all day and night. And then when time permits, writing some Java code with a couple interns we've got to plug into the Floodlight OpenFlow controller. Kind of proofing some of the named concepts that we talked about, and then writing some posts on at networkstatic.net, and I'm on the Twitters at networkstatic. And I do want to say I'm excited for the symposium. The last one you guys did was a huge resource for me to be able to, when an executive comes in and asks what's this about, or a new intern, go listen to this about five times and then come back. So having that material to reference and content is just huge. So thanks, guys.
Yeah, well, that's we are looking at – I'm working with the vendors now to organize another one of those symposiums for March next year. And I'm still not sure what the topic will be. I'm not sure whether it'll be SDN or switching or fabrics, or I think we may actually do a mixture so that there's something there for everybody to listen to and to discuss. And of course, Mr. Ethan Banks, any excitement ahead for you?
Yeah, I'm getting ready to put two 6509s to bed that have that were at one point the core of a data center and also the access layer as well, because it was a pretty small shop. So I should have a whole bunch of fexes that have been racked up by some of the guys that I work with, and the fiber all plumbed. And then I got to work on migrating all of the hosts over to the FEX infrastructure. We did our dev area, and it went very well. So now we're ready to do prod and put the 6509s to bed. And that'll be the big thing that I'm working on. I'm also supporting a couple of voiceover IP moves that are happening, where we're cutting folks off of their whatever it is they're using for phone today and putting them on a Cisco VoIP system. That's on my list, and I don't even remember the rest of it until I look and find out whatever's most important. Someone will tell me whatever it is I'm forgetting.
And you'll be updated on a clock every day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I got some editing to do on packetpushers.net for the guys that are submitting blogs. I have editor duties that I must go in, and I fell behind this week as I was away on vacation and not away from keyboard quite a bit. I got to do that and get some blog stuff published, and all the good stuff, and I'll tweet about it at EC Banks and blog about it on packetpushers.net.
And, of course, I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com or on the Twitters as at etherealmind. As always, love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com. Let us know what you're thinking. Even better, get over to our forum at forum.packetpushers.net. You can have a discussion with other people about the show. Please do so. We value your feedback and your contributions. It helps us to know what's actually happening in the real world, because sometimes we also live in the bubbles that are our real lives, and it's useful to know what everybody else thinks. Remember to check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net. You can leave comments on the blog post that accompanies this. And, of course, all the show links and links to people's Twitter handles and everything are there. Follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. And, as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.
The show had something for everybody. We did firewalls. We did Lisp. We did 5K.
Unicorn.
And we even beat up on Checkpoint again. Hooray.
Well, that's the goal every time, isn't it?